Hi, this is Dorian Williamson from Northumbria.
And Jim Field from Northumbria.
And we're here today talking on the Lovecast podcast.
Hello, and welcome to HP Lovecast Presents Transmissions, where we collect brief interviews by creators with new or upcoming projects. We'll open up to guests reading an excerpt from their project, and then follow through with an interview proper. Transmissions posts on the last day of each month. I'm Nicholas Dyack, a pop culture scholar of Peplum films, industrial music, horror studies, and the editor of The New Peplum from McFarland.
And I'm Michelle Brittany, editor of James Bond in Popular Culture, and the Bram Stoker-nominated Horror in Space. I write on all things pop culture with special emphasis on horror, fantasy, and spy genres. Nicholas and I co-edited Horror in Horror Literature from Gothic to Postmodern, also from McFarlane. In today's episode, we interviewed Erica T. Wirth, author of her novel White Horse, and Chris Philbrick, author of The Darkness of Diggory Finch series. Let's get started. Our first transmission is with Erica T. Wirth. Erica is a professor, novelist, poet, and writer, whose works include the novel Crazy Horse's Girlfriend, the poetry collection Indian Trains, and 1,000 Horses Out to Sea, and the short story collection Buckskin Cocaine. She is also hardcore into heavy metal. Erica joins us today to talk about her new novel, White Horse. Welcome, Erica.
There was something strange, mysterious even, about the White Horse tonight. Normally, it was merely an Indian bar, my Indian bar. But there was a milky, dreamy quality to the red lights swinging over the pool tables, like the wind from the open doors was bringing them something new, something I'd pushed away for as long as I could remember. Debbie, do we have to talk about her again? I took another swig of my beer and slammed it back down, eyeing my cousin as I did. She would never let the subject go, no matter how much I rebuffed her. I sighed, taking in the dank, wet wood smell of the bar, the harsh laughter of the bikers in the booth behind me. The thing is, I interrupted her with a brush of my hand. I hoped Nick, the bartender, would come by and ask if I needed a refill, but all I could see was the mirror in front of me, the words Miller High Life emblazoned in gold cursive on the front. Right next to it, a sign read, First Fight, Last Drink, Permanent 86. Besides us, the bartender and the bikers, the White Horse was empty. It was always empty, but I loved it. I loved the long wooden bar, the cats wandering in and out. The mangy orange one was my favorite. She liked to sit on top of the bar and let me pet her while she closed her cloudy eyes and purred. Debbie shifted her weight on the stool, the plastic crackling as she did, the bar stirring around me like a bad dream. All I'm saying is that you don't know your mom's story. Yeah, okay, Debbie, that's great, I said. I signaled Nick when he came out of the bathroom. Two more, I said, hoping he'd remember. A couple of Dene came through the doors, quiet the way they were, and made their way to the pool table in the back. One of them saw me when he came over to order a beer, and he gave me the friendly head nod, his black hair glistening red in the faint bar light. I nodded back, and that strange feeling I'd had earlier flooded back into me. The thing is, Debbie said, you know how we check in on your dad? I hung my head. Yeah, so I went over there the other day to do that and some cleaning, because I know the nurse is great and everything, but I like to see how he is. And I'd just come home from work and was dropping the kids off. Jesus, Debbie, if you're not going to let it go, spit it out. Okay, she said, starting again. So mom had been pushing me to clear some of the boxes in the attic, and like we were going to haul them out and throw them in the dumpster, but mom seemed to want to look through them. And mainly they were full of old toys and papers and rusting appliances, but then we found something. What? I whispered, and that dreamy quality snapped back. Something of your mom's. I was silent. My mother, the woman who had abandoned me when I was only 2 days old. The woman who my father had been so devastated over, he began to take long drives, a bottle of Jack in between his legs. The woman who had made it so that I had to care for my dad like a baby instead of the other way around, after he'd gotten into an accident that had left his body but taken his mind. Cecilia.
We are joined today by Erica T. Wirth. Erica, it is wonderful to see you. How are you doing?
really good. It's October 1st, and you know, I live in suburbia, so they're like all of the Halloween decorations coming out, and they always give me such joy. Like last year, someone did a whole plethora of all of the slashers in their yard. Like there was a Jason and there was a Freddy and there was noises, and it was fabulous. So in any case, I am so honored to be on your podcast. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I do like the idea. It's like September 30th. You step outside, the world looks normal. You wake up the next day, you walk outside, boom, it's not Christmas decorations everywhere. It's Halloween decorations, just like that. Well, it's so great to have you too. You have a new book coming out called White Horse. So tell us about it.
Basically White Horse is the name of the Indian bar in Denver. It's been here for, I think, minimum 30 years, if not 50. Sadly, it did just close. The guy just got older and, you know, he couldn't do it anymore. And Denver, of course, is gentrifying really, really wildly. And the real estate is probably very, very valuable, and they're probably going to plow over it. So I got some great pictures beforehand. And it's sad because it's such a Denver institution, the White Horse, and there are just a ton of like cool Indian bars across the country. Well, not a ton, actually, a short list, and it's one of them. And so to see it go away when you know, when I've been in that bar and seen such, you know, urban Indian stuff go down, it's kind of sad. But in any case, the novel is like, in short, it's a literary horror novel. And it's about a woman named Carrie who loves heavy metal, and she loves horror, specifically Dave Mustaine of Megadeth, and specifically Stephen King, right? Heavy metal is it's either like you hate it or you love it, right? And she despises her mother because she believes her mother abandoned her when she was 2 days old. And her super sweet, well-intentioned white cousin Debbie is like, I found this bracelet of your mother's. And Carrie's like, yeah, thanks. And just sort of like puts it in her bag and is like, whatever. But the minute she touches it, her mother's ghost starts haunting her. And this, you know, essentially evil Bigfoot that's from Chickasaw stories, as like Carrie, I'm of Chickasaw and Apache descent, starts invading her dreams. And she decides, well, you know, I guess I have to find out what happened to my mother after all.
And what was the catalyst for your novel?
Like I said earlier when we were chatting, I honestly kind of just wanted to go back to my nerd roots. You know, I started reading fantasy as a kid. I loved myself some elves. I was super into Piers Anthony. That was my jam. Then I started reading horror because horror is kind of fantasy's dark side. And I had a rugged upbringing. My dad was an alcoholic, and my parents were from very working class backgrounds, and my mom was American Indian and my dad was white, and there's just a lot of conflict. And I was bused to a tough little school in Idaho Springs, Colorado. So I spent most of my childhood there, and you know, kids were a little tough. And so I escaped through nerd literature. And when I got older, I started reading science fiction. And then I went to college and then to a doctorate in creative writing and literature. And that, they kind of steamroll the nerd out of you, you know, or if you like crime, they steamroll that out of you, which is kind of a shame. And I think that's somewhat changing, that people are beginning to understand that literary is not a genre. It's a series of conventions that can apply to any genre, right? Realism or crime or, you know. And so for me, I think for years I'd started reading like fantasy and science fiction. I finally started reading horror again. I would allow myself to read horror because I knew that was the portal to a real change in my life. And lo and behold, once I started reading horror, my work changed. The book was a gargantuan mess years ago. It was a collection of short stories. And then it was actually an okay collection of short stories. Then it was a gargantuan mess of a sort of realistic or literary novel. And then it slowly became a horror novel. And I revised and revised and revised. And in some ways, it's a love song to old Denver, which is slowly disappearing as it becomes this like extremely beautiful but gentrified city. And in other ways, like I said, it was a return to my nerd roots. And the third part of it was a sort of mystery around my grandmother's death. My grandmother either suicided or was murdered by her husband. And there's a lot of mystery still around her death. And I think with urban Indians, and especially if you're of descent and you're not a member of a federally recognized tribe, the way in which you're categorized is not necessarily under that, you know, missing and murdered Indigenous movement that so many, you know, people are categorized under. But it's important that we are included in that, because so many of us, you know, encounter sexual harassment or violence or death by other people, suicide, all these kinds of things. And I think it's important to take into consideration that where we're coming from is a part of why we're a part of that movement. So in any case, that mystery around her death really pushed me to like think about this novel, even though I fictionalized like 99% of the rest of it. So,
well, you said it was a mess of a novel, then it's some story. I mean, it's gone quite through a journey. So I should ask, you know, any challenges that you encountered while editing it, or transmorphing it to other mediums, or something that you learned while doing it?
Totally. And when you said transmorphing, I was thinking Transformers. And so I pictured like the novels, like a cool Transformer.
I like that idea. Transformer book.
Right. Yeah. I love that idea of like, it can become Carrie, who will whack you in the nuts with a golf club, you know? So yeah, the big challenge for me in my entire literary career was just not accepting that I was a horror writer and that was something that I wanted to do. I kind of bought into the notion that a real writer wrote realism. And it was a mistake for me, because I stand by my previous books, of course, but the joy that I have in reading science fiction and fantasy, and especially horror, and in writing it, is irreplaceable. And I've never had so much fun writing. Never. I've had fun writing, but I've never had this much fun. But the bigger challenge overall was structure. I know this is kind of dry and professory, but in academia, you know, a lot of times, even though you'll take creative writing workshops and you'll study literature and literature courses, you don't talk a lot about structure. You talk about meaning and language and theme and depth and things like that, and even characterization. And you'll talk loosely about structure, but when it comes to putting together a novel, there isn't enough talk about that. And I think when I would ask people would either be like, oh, screw structure, screw plot, that's Hollywood. And I was like, I guess, you know, I really value story. And I think it's what propels people to read. And it's what all of us loved when we first started reading. When I met my partner, he was becoming a thriller writer, right? So I taught him a lot. And in turn, he was saying to me, well, these are these more nuts and bolts books that I'm reading, like Save the Cat, right? Everyone makes fun of it, but it's a great blueprint for somebody who has a messy head like mine and who has studied like all the fancy stuff, but not enough of the pragmatic nuts and bolts. So reading that and Thrill Me and Chuck Wendig's Damn Fine Story, Jane Cleland's Mastering Suspense, Structure and Plot, those were seminal texts for me and really taught me in a very concrete nuts and bolts way how to put together a novel in a way that was compelling and structured. And so those were the challenges for me for years.
No, we're with you on the structure. Our background is we do academic writing, like a lot of essays, and it sounds dry, but I like it. We had a professor long ago that says it's like, you know, a reverse murder story where you tell what happened first and you work backwards. So your opening paragraph is, okay, in this essay, here's what I'm going to do. Here's how I'm going to do it. And one, to me, it makes it easier to write, but two, more importantly, it makes it easier for readers to read. And like, I know exactly what's going to happen in this essay if I need to cite or scorch or something. So yeah, no, super with you on structure, that it's important. And I think sometimes it can be hard to do, and you know, things like note carding or, you know, doing a little decision tree or something really helps.
I think a lot of it is that a lot of writers, they especially write, if you're in academia, you know, they're kind of trained to think that somehow it should just come from them naturally, or it should come from reading, and that if they have to like go like climax and you know catalyst and whatever, that somehow this diminishes their talent. And I think like what I think it does is it just creates an environment of like fear and confusion, and it takes even longer to get where you could have gone if you just read the nuts and bolts craft book, you know?
Yeah. Because your story is a nod to White Horse, a bar in Denver, have to ask, do you have a suggested soundtrack or music to accompany White Horse?
I do. I actually have it on Spotify, and I actually need to learn how to share it. Carrie's main band, right, is Megadeth. And it's, you know, I think it's, gosh, what is it? Hangar 18. Hangar 18 is her big song, right? This is what she loves. And she also loves Megadeth or Metallica, right? But she also loves, you know, because she's like a Gen X kid, there's, you know, some grunge music she does listen to that, you know, I listen to a lot, which was, you know, Nirvana, Pearl Jam. But there are like cool local bands, like A Feather and Bone. And it's a local heavy metal band in Denver. And that's like who she goes to see a lot. And that's in my little, you know, Spotify list, my Spotify podcast list, or not podcast list, my list.
Well, if you figure out how to share, let us know, and we'll drop it in the notes.
So people can walk out, because, you know, there's folks who, you know, write to music, but it's also important. Like, we're seeing this more common where folks will put, like, at the end of their book, like, a playlist to listen to while reading. And, you know, there's nothing, you know, better than, you know, sitting on your belly, you know, book in front with an ambient soundtrack or something going in the background. Create your own mood.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I found that a lot of times the music that I write to is not the music that inspires the work. So in other words, like, I can't have stuff that's too distracting in terms of lyrics. I like to have something that's sort of like fun and propulsive to write to. But in terms of like when I'm in the car and I'm thinking and I'm listening to music, that's what's that will sometimes be the inspiration for certain things.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask what you were rocking out to while composing, right, Horace?
You know, I think I have, like, it's weird. I have, I do listen to heavy metal, and I listen to hip hop, and I listen to indie music in general. And I do listen to everything that I listed. But when I write, I actually kind of like more, like I said, almost stuff that if there are lyrics, they're not distracting. Stuff that has like a really propulsive beat, you know? And so what's in my writing music is honestly as random as can be.
She probably rocked out to a lot of Daft Punk.
I'd be okay. Yeah, my boyfriend likes the punk.
So with all your writing, not necessarily just Right Horse, but your body work, what would you say, we're going to call it auteur element, but, you know, this, like, what is the part of your writing that you think is like your trademark, your distinctive you that comes out in your writing?
Yeah, you know, when I saw that question, that you had sent over, I thought, this is an excellent question. And it's one that I suppose I've puzzled apart, because, you know, it's funny, like I said, being an academic, when you take these GRE subject tests, you learn A, if you have an ear for it in terms of style, and B, how distinctive people's styles actually are, because there are lines, like it'll give you two lines and be like, is this Leslie Marmon Silko or is this? And you're like, it is Louise Erdrich, right? And so, yeah, I don't know. It's a great question. I think that I love a good basic, breakdown of description, action, dialogue. I think that, structure, like I said, matters. I like propulsivity. But if I think there's one thing that kind of, if you read a couple of lines of mine that you would recognize, it would be the particular way in which I use language. And I think that I like combining the really gritty with the poetic. That's something I like smashing together. And I think my particular way in which I talk about being an urban Indian, because for a lot of people like Tommy Orange, right, people were like wild for him because, you know, if you're not Native, you're like, wow, Native's not from a reservation, even though hilariously, it's been common for generations and generations and generations. It's just not talked about much here in the United States. It's talked more about in Canada and maybe Mexico, but not so much here. It's like people kind of imagine the sort of idea of the authentic Indian on the reservation, whatever that means to them. And so for me, I think what is a marker of my work is my family has been urban for generations. They were Apache from northern Mexico, and they went into Texas, and they were of some Black descent, and they were Chickasaw and Cherokee, and they were in the Southeast. And being of Black descent, you know, in the Southeast, even the natives owned slaves. So they were like, we're out. And they met in Texas. And like a lot of people in Minneapolis, Denver, LA, Chicago, the Dallas, Houston area, they formed this sort of urban Indian culture, which revolved a lot around powwows and Native American church. And so I think that my sense of language combined with the way in which I talk about, you know, people who were culturally, you know, native, urban natives for generation is probably the way in which you'd see my work and be like, this is Erica's.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, Erica, we're wrapping up on our interview today and would love to know, first, congratulations on White Horse, but also, are there future plans or news that you can share with our listeners?
Yeah, I just want to thank you one more time for having me here. It's been such an honor. And thank you so much about White Horse. It's, you know, the small presses I publish with are lovely folks. They have beat it up for me. They're wonderful. But yes, it was kind of cool to get to the big five, right? It's taken a lifetime. And I'm super excited. It releases November 1st, and they're putting me on a face-to-face tour. And, you know, I love this book. But yes, I have been working on something new that's tentatively, I loved the idea of calling it Psychomantium. But, you know, the people I was working with thought that was a bit too much. So they suggested Room 904, and I kind of like that. And Room 904 is about a woman who, it's much more New Denver. And, you know, she's kind of more of a millennial, and she's kind of like perky, but she's also, you know, has a doctorate in psychology. But she becomes a detective for the dead, because even though she's never believed in the dead, and that's not her thing, when her sister suicides, these sort of powers are turned on, and suddenly she's able to sometimes even read people's minds, mainly read the minds of like the dead who are still around. And so she goes around to mansions and old hotels. And what happens is the Brown Palace, which is like a historic hotel in Denver, she's asked to go there. And instead of the normal ghost that's haunting, it's her sister that's haunting the room that was normally haunted by the ghosts that used to haunt it. So yes, that's what I'm working on. As you can see, it's a little bit jumbled in my head, but yeah.
Well, that sounds exciting.
It sounds like a little bit of you're into urban exploration into it, mm-hmm. as well.
Okay. I don't know anything about that. I'll have to check that out.
That's a lot of, you know, folks, you know, modern day going into like abandoned you know, hotels or schools, mm-hmm. or, you know, just filming it, exploring around. A lot of folks do it with dead malls now too, but yeah. It's fun to watch on YouTube for sure.
I like the idea of spirit being supplanted by another spirit. So I think that's going to be very interesting, and what the dynamic is between the two spirits, because you would think that either they coexist, so to speak, or, you know.
Right.
That'll be.
Yeah. You are talking about ghost hauntings or ghost hunters, right? And so, yeah, I have seen, you know, footage of that, and that stuff is awesome. It's rad. But yeah, that's kind of what I'm kind of getting into. Like I like making the plot interesting and having lots of twists and turns. And so that's part of what the twist and turn is about in this one.
Ooh.
Well, we hope, in advance, again, congrats for White Horse that it's super successful, but also your upcoming project will also go smooth and be super successful for you too.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you so much for having me here.
Our next transmission is with Chris Philbrook. Chris is a prolific best-selling author known for the multi-volume post-apocalyptic Adrian's Undead Diary that originally began as storytelling via blog posts. Chris joins us today to talk about his new cosmic horror series, The Darkness of Diggory Finch, which includes The Awakening and The Twelve. Welcome, Chris.
All right, so we're going to read a few paragraphs from, it's about halfway through The Awakening, which is, you know, book one of the series. And our main character, Diggory Finch, has been looped into some really weird happenings in his town of Twin Falls. And he brings his best friend in town, a lady named Alicia, out. And they're in a field, and they're tracking down the movement of something that they saw that was, you know, kaiju sized, you know, through the mist and the clouds. They saw something moving, and they just went out in the direction, and they find a footprint that's big enough to fall into. And Alicia steps into it and falls down. Her foot made contact with something firm, so she kept kicking, prying off the monster that was trying to kill her as Diggory pulled her straight from the earth like a human weed. Her pain was legendary, unthinkable, but she ignored it. She grit her teeth like a monster herself and battled the pain just as she battled the actual creature trying to kill her. Diggory grunted in exertion as she kicked once more, and she erupted up from the wet grass as if she'd been spat out by the world itself. Her weight smashed up into Diggory, and the two went to the ground, her body crushing his into the grass several feet from the dent in the field that had almost killed her. They won. She cried out in pain and rolled over, holding her destroyed leg up to look at. Nothing. Her boot was on her foot, and all the flesh was where it had been where they'd started their hike together. What the fuck? Are you okay? Diggory pleaded, checking her over with manic fear. His eyes darted over her, then to the seemingly innocent green vegetation that had tried to eat her. He threw his backpack off and produced a small hatchet out of it. He fingered the tool with nervous tension, ready to strike. What just happened? Alicia grunted through the pain of injuries she didn't have. The intensity ticked down the tiniest bit with each passing second. Was that the thing? The monster with 1,000 eyes? Diggory stopped and pulled a lighter out of his pocket. A piece of wooden road stake wrapped in cloth appeared from the unzippered opening of his backpack, and he lit it. The small fire caught immediately. It flared into bright light, casting away some of the pallor of the falling rain. Then, the light from the fire surged brighter. Torch glowing like an incandescent sun in Diggory's hands, the mist exploded away, peeling off from them like sheets in a storm. As they departed, the day dissolved with the mist, leaving them with a starry, mountain-ringed void instead of the real world. Purples, blues, magentas, and black, mostly black, hung above them, dotted with stars and constellations that had no home above Earth. Mountains carved from jagged bones loomed upward, catching them in a bowl that had once been a country pasture, but now was an alien hellscape covered in hard rocks, discordant humming lichens and mosses and protrusions of petrified trees and corpses frozen still, mummified corpses of people, corpses of indescribable monsters with anatomies that couldn't possibly lead to life. Above them on all sides were moon-sized eyes leering over the foreign peaks set in ever-shadowed faces larger than anything that had ever lived. 10, 12, more, all cloaked in robes made of death and madness, each looking down at Alicia and Diggory, alone, exposed, afraid. Like obelisks of pure malice and judgment, the Leviathan giants, the rulers of this place, gazed down on them, and the feeling of greed and terrible excitement washed downward over the two frightened people. These monsters were watching. These monsters were happy. These monsters wanted more.
We are joined by Chris Philbrook this evening. Chris, it is wonderful to see you. How are you doing?
It's great to be here, and I am doing very well. Thank you for asking.
Oh, awesome. Well, you have a new cosmic horror series out called The Darkness of Diggory Finch, and it's got two books in it so far, The Awakening and The 12. So why don't you tell us about this series? You know, what's it about?
It's my kind of a twist on a modern Lovecraftian tale. And it's, you know, the main character is Diggory Finch, and Diggory's, you know, early 30s. And he lives in New England. And when the book opens, he's working kind of a dead end job in Boston doing, you know, late night security and that kind of stuff. And he's not happy, and he's never really been happy, and he doesn't know what'll make him happy. And he gets a phone call from his dad informing him that his kind of estranged grandma, who lives on the border of New Hampshire and Vermont, has passed away. And she's left him the family home. in a little town called Twin Falls, which is the setting for the story. And Diggory moves back and, you know, says, all right, this is my great chance. I'm going to get this house and my life will be better and it'll be small town and I can just sort of reboot myself. And he gets back to Twin Falls and pretty quickly realizes that everything that he's known about his family hasn't been the real truth. His dad has kept secrets from him. His mother has been oblivious to things. And he finds out that, you know, Grandma Beatrice was wealthy. She had quite a bit of money. And he's wondering, you know, why didn't we get any of that money while we were alive? And where the hell did this money come from? And he starts to dig into it. And he very quickly starts to get blockaded by the locals. There seemed to be a very interested group of people in the town that go out of their way to make him feel very, very comfortable there. But also they go out of his way to make sure that he can't find out things about his family's past. And when Diggory starts pulling at those threads, things start to come unraveled and he unearths a whole lot of problems for a whole lot of people.
It seems like you spent a lot of time kind of world building. Can you tell us what the catalyst was for the series?
Yeah, I'm a world building fanatic. It's like my hobby. I was thinking about, you know, what I wanted to write in terms of, you know, projects. And this is going back a couple of years ago. And I love the idea of like self-contained settings, where the main characters don't travel, they don't deviate, they don't leave a defined geographical kind of area, because you can really get into things. And a big inspiration for that kind of storyline is David Lynch's stuff like Twin Peaks, right? Where, you know, this entire story, which has massive scope, takes place in a town with about 20 characters. And I wanted to tell a story like that. So I invented the towns of Twin Falls. I have a map of it. I have every place is, you know, located on a digital map so I can keep references and notes, and the streets have names and all that jazz. And once I had the world, then I had my sandbox and I could just start moving the pieces around and arranging, the characters in the story to kind of do what I wanted it to do.
Just as a quick follow-up, Chris, how long did that take you to really kind of flesh out the world and do your digital map and things like that before you actually started writing?
Well, there was two phases of it for me. And I have ADHD. And I have the kind of ADHD where when my mind sinks its teeth into a task, I get the hyper-focus. And when the task is positive, it's fantastic, right? Because I can get so much done and it's really high quality work. The downside is when I hyper-focus on something like a, you know, video game and I lose 3 or 4 months of my life. But the first phase of creating the story was coming up with, you know, a character that didn't have to leave or a character that couldn't leave. So I came up with the idea of Diggory Finch, and the problems that Diggory encounters will follow him no matter where he goes. So in the story, he decides to stay where it seems like he'll have the most amount of resources and the most amount of access to information. And that took me a couple months, coming up with like a non-tropey, non-cheesy, as original as you can do nowadays. And, you know, everything's already been done. And then the second phase of it was like the logistics, coming up with the characters, coming up with, you know, the intricate plots in the background and, you know, the twist. And then like what the buildings look like, what kind of monsters are we talking about? And then like literally drawing a map. Like I sat down, I think it took me a week to do the map and to drop all the things and places in. But that's mostly because, you know, again, hyper-focus. If I didn't, you know, catch that muse of manic creation, it might have taken me a couple of months, but ride the wave, as they say.
I gotta ask, since you mentioned you're a video game player and also a David Lynch fan, I'll ask, have you ever played the video game Alan Wake or the video game Deadly Premonition?
I knew you were going to ask about Alan Wake the second that happened. I knew it. Believe it or not, I've never played it. However, I had two friends who were obsessed with it, And when they were doing their playthroughs, I would just hang out with them and literally sit on the couch and watch them play. And I think I've seen the whole game through start to finish, I think maybe three times between the two of them. And I love that game. Like, I love it. Well, Deadly Premonition, I've never played though.
No, I definitely recommend Deadly Premonition. It is a quirky game. It is basically Twin Peaks, the video game. I mean, an FBI agent comes to a small Pacific Northwest town to solve a murder. There's weird messages and a coffee, weird music and everything. It is seriously Twin Peaks in video game form. And I gotta recommend that one. It looks like an old PS2 game, even though it's more recent than that. But for really quirky, like playing in a very finite sandbox horror Lynchian type stuff. But yeah, Alan Wake is awesome. And I'm glad that there's a proper sequel for it.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Well, speaking of, you know, games with sequels and entries and stuff, I gotta ask, with the Diggory Finch series, like, what's the biggest thing you want to accomplish with it?
As a professional writer, quote unquote, I need to be able to, you know, tell a story that's entertaining enough to make money, right? Because, you know, I have bills and whatnot. So, you know, make money. That's the generic answer. But from like a creative standpoint, I really want to tell a story that takes some of the more universal concepts from, you know, Lovecraft's style and updates them and kind of gives them a little bit more relevant footing in, you know, today's, you know, cultural environment, and, you know, kind of carry that sort of past forward. You know, that's a big element that I want to achieve with it. And secondly, Diggory struggles with mental health. And my degree is in psychology, and I worked as a counselor for about 10 years before I really got into writing. So for me, being as authentic as I can to mental health in my writing is like, that's important to me. You know, like, it's my background and I know a lot about it relatively, and writing characters that have real emotional and psychological reactions to frankly terrifying things has value, you know. And when you connect with readers or listeners that have had those same kind of traumatic events or those same levels of mental illness, and they see a character in a book that has some similarities to them, it's hugely inspiring. And it's very relatable to those people. And it's, you know, it goes back to the idea of representation, right? And I love doing that. I love giving people who may feel like they're on the fringe a character and a storyline that they can feel, you know, kind of belongs to them. So the series, you know, in theory, will execute all of those things and, you know, give people a character that they can relate to and allow me to play in the, a mythos inspired universe.
It's great that you're bringing those up because of our next question. And the fact that we were just talking about Alan Wake, which has very interesting characters, but you're also kind of, you know, dealing with also some mental health issues and trying to understand what's reality, what isn't. One of the things that comes from that, you know, one way that we deal with it seems to be humor. And so, you know, in a genre where it is full of dread, how do you pull humor from that and do it kind of, I guess, you know, psychologically in a way that's, I'm going to say, healthy, kind of an air, you know?
Well, you know, it's the concept of coping mechanisms, right? We all find different ways to deal with stress or trauma or anxiety or, you know, whatever it is that's troubling us. And as a human being myself, I would say my primary coping mechanism is humor. So I was bullied viciously as a kid. Viciously. And for a very long time, I just kind of took it and was miserable and whatnot. And then there was a certain point where my wit caught up to my courage and I stopped being afraid to respond to the bullying. And that's kind of how I developed my reaction of stress or trauma or aggression or whatever with humor. So when people called me names, I just rolled with it, and I would say something funny back to them and turn their insult back on them. And very quickly, bullies found out that I wasn't that fun to tease, because I was able to make them feel horrible for saying horrible things to me. And that kind of, evolved over my whole life, where instead of being bullied, at some point I had a growth spurt and I was no longer the target of bullying because people were afraid that I'd get mad at them. But I took that sort of reaction of humor and carried it into, scary situations, where I would sort of like, all right, well, this is terrifying. I'm going to make a joke about it, make everyone laugh, and kind of, lower the temperature of the room. And then we're going to deal with it in a slightly more stable, emotional state. And that's just kind of the person I am. And I've managed to take that sort of personality trait that I have and turn it into a kind of a writing style, where I have characters who are in just absurd, bad situations, just, atrocious, unthinkable, completely fictional, bad stuff. And I write characters that have senses of humor, similar to mine. And I just, if I was faced in that situation, I think of, the completely illogical, insane thing that I would say to kind of like make everyone laugh and take a moment. And I just write it. And what happens is you come up with these characters that no matter how bad it gets are always able to just sort of like, all right, well, that sucked. And then just like figure out a way to deal with it, or figure out a way to run, or accept the fact that they're screwed. And that's how I kind of bring the humor into those things, where I just it could be worse, right? Like, and then it can't get worse. And that's usually when the books, take a sharp turn for the worse.
Well, you'd mentioned that that's something you incorporated into your writing style, and you also write across multiple genres. You mentioned before we started the interview proper that you do a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction. You're now doing cosmic horror with this story. So would you consider that like your auteur element, like your unique aspect that you bring to your writing? This is a Chris Philbrook story because it has this in it. Or would you say there's something else that's in your stories?
Well, I think when people describe my writing, the things that they like about my writing, it's easier for me to kind of look over their shoulder and listen to what they say about me than it is for me to turn the mirror on myself. The humor of my writing is definitely something that I hear a lot. People enjoy the kind of sarcastic, witty banter and, frankly, gallows humor that I managed to work into scenes, because it takes absurdity and makes kind of light of it. That's definitely one thing. The I would say the other really big thing that I hear a lot about is the mental health thing. Like, I incorporate that aspect to just about everything I write. And again, people really feel the ups and downs that my characters have. I'm very transparent. I show it in an authentic way, and it resonates with people who have been through those things. They've had that trauma, they've had that grief, they've had that guilt, whatever. And I write about it in a way that's psychologically accurate. And I have enough talent as a writer to make it also interesting to read or listen to. And I think the third thing that I hear a lot about that I know that I work really hard on creatively is writing dialogue that feels real. Our characters often wear plot armor, where, they're able to stay alive through things, or they have conversations that are uniquely beneficial to move the story forward. And I tend to play around in those areas and have conversations that happen that build character that don't necessarily move the plot forward. So my characters have these conversations that feel grounded and real and genuine and, kind of awkward. And they read like the way people, I hope they read like the way people actually talk. So I think those are the three things that, define the writing of Chris Philbrook, such as it is. For now, until I decide to do something different that no one likes, we'll see.
I like the idea of your dialogue for the plot, but just to chill and develop characters. I think of like early Tarantino work, like Reservoir Dogs, or sitting around the diner talking about tipping. has no bearing on the plot, but you know, you walk away with that was actually a pretty funny scene, and you have
right.
that pink, you know, aside every person is color coded, Mr. Pink, Mr. White, whatever, you now know their philosophy on if they're going to be more of a good guy or a bad guy.
Well, right.
That gives you insight, you know, sometimes it's the small things that'll give you insight into a person and how they're probably going to react in a bigger situation. So I think that's very helpful.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the way people react in conversations and the kinds of words they use can tell you a lot about them. You know, like the whole representation thing, right? Like if someone is using certain kinds of slurs or certain kind of loose languages or certain kind of slang, that can tell you a lot about a person without ever having to describe it.
Well, we're getting to the end of our interview. It just went zippity-doo-dah so quickly, but what is coming up for you? Do you have any exciting news that you can share with our listeners and upcoming projects?
Well, I like to juggle. I like to keep a lot of projects going at the same time so I can kind of bounce around to wherever my my focus for the day wants to go. But, you know, it's about Halloween. And right now, the 13th book in my big post-apocalyptic series, Adrian's Undead Diary, is slated to release on Halloween in all formats. And that's that one's been a long time coming. I think the last one came out over a year ago. So, yeah, I've had a lot of people sending me a lot of messages. Hey, where'd you go? So knowing that that's coming out now-ish is fantastic news. And, you know, Diggory's first book, The Awakening, just got this big promotion on Audible, and it's, it, you know, the sales on it were just fantastic. And I'm really hoping that, you know, if, you know, a few thousand extra people find book one and they like it, they're going to go on to book two, and the series can really have legs, and can connect with a, you know, really large audience. That's my hope right now. But
just as a quick follow-up question with your Darkness of Diggory Finch, what kind of series are you kind of thinking of doing? As long as your other one, 13 books, or are you kind of thinking more of a trilogy?
No, 13 books is kind of insanity, I'll be honest with you. That series originally ended at 8, and then I took a few years off and came back to it because I had new ideas. Diggory was more defined from the beginning, and my current outline, and I outline pretty loosely, so I have some flexibility. The outline's about 5 books. And so far, you know, we're done with book 2 now, and book 3 is about to get started. We're still on target for 5. If the series really blows up in popularity, which is possible, I might make it 6. Just so I can kind of expand into some more character development, and I can kind of linger on things that I might not be able to in 5, but probably 5, maybe 6.
Well, on a side note on that is, you know, congrats, book 13 coming out on Halloween. I mean, I guess you can't get more Halloween-ish than that for in season, but congrats on that. Congrats on
thank you.
Finch, you know, getting it start and everything and all your other endeavors. It's been an honor to have you on the podcast, and we wish you continued success, sir.
Thank you. I'm just elated to be here and talk with people that have similar interests, and it's just great to feel like I'm part of this community too.
Well, thank you so very much.
And that concludes our transmissions for this episode. We'd like to thank Dorian Williamson and Jim Field of the band Northumbria for providing a bumper for this episode. Northumbria is a dark ambient band on the legendary Cryo Chamber label. Aside from their albums Helleland, Markland, and Vinland, Northumbria have also contributed to Cryo Chamber's various Lovecraftian collaboration releases. We wish Northumbria success with their music and projects.
For November, we'll be posting our regular HP Lovecast episode mid-month and another episode of Transmissions at the end of the month. Details will be posted on our social media channels soon.
We have some upcoming appearances. Nick will be a guest on the Galactic Terror's YouTube show on Thursday, November 10th, and he'll be reading an excerpt from his essay, Meteor Madness, Lovecraftian Horror and Consumerism in the Battle for Small Town America. That essay is included in my Horror in Space book. We also have been chatting with the fan-to-fan crew in recent weeks, so there'll be a couple of upcoming discussions that we are excited to have been a part of. We'll update the show notes with links once these shows post, but please go check out Galactic Terrors and Fan-to-Fan. Each have fantastic content well worth watching and listening to.
Please contact us if you'd like to be a guest on Transmissions. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our website is hplovecast.com, and of course you can email us at hplovecast@gmail.com. If you've enjoyed this broadcast, please subscribe and feel free to explore our archives. Consider supporting us by purchasing our books. We both have Amazon author pages with links to all the books that we've either edited or contributed to with individual essay chapters. Or if you feel like donating a dollar or two, we also have a coffee account. A link is provided in the show notes. As always, thank you for listening.